Happy New Year!
Yeah!
It's February. We've been really busy, but
I'm sorry.
We're very sorry.
We have created a new awesome issue of a magazine, though.
Yep.
Come on. Yeah, that's available yesterday.
Yeah.
When and we're going to edit this. And that's not the only thing that's new. We've got a new person.
Hello!
Hey!
Hello!
What's your name?
Where are you from?
I'm Ben Everard from Worcestershire.
You may know Ben Everard from Worcestershire from such cover features as Learn to Hack.
Or crack, depending on your sensibilities.
Yeah. Yes.
The Linux format cover feature that is at this very moment responsible for all kinds of malevolent behaviour across the internet.
Remember, the skills you learn in the LXF dojo are for self-protection only.
Yeah.
Right. With that, welcome to Podcast Series 4, Episode 1. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
I'm Ben Everard.
Yay!
Hey. Hey! Cheers! In this episode, we've got news from Ubuntu, Red Hat, Samsung, Greg Crower Hartman, and more. Discovery of the Week, Ransom Raves, Speak Your Brains, our open ballot as well. If you like the sound of that, and if you like you want to possibly put some money our way, you can subscribe to Linux Format at tinyurl.com/LXFOffer1, and that's a really good deal, which I believe is buy 8, get 5 free. You also get access to the subscriber-only area of the website, which gives you DRM-free PDFs of loads and loads
everything.
Of back issues. Everything.
Yeah, everything from about SU60, whenever we started doing it.
It's something like... it's thousands, isn't it?
It must be thousands by now.
Millions of words.
Many, many words. Many good words.
Yeah.
All of them about Linux.
Most of them about Linux.
A few about BSD. Anyway, subscribe.
Great, okay, so that brings us to the news section, and since we haven't recorded a podcast for, about 2 months now?
6 weeks.
6 weeks. There's a lot of news for us to cover, so we're going to turn this into a lightning news round today. I'm going to read out the news story, and everyone else is going to respond in the shortest space possible for what they think about the news. So, Ubuntu introduces the HUD. Graham?
Oh, rubbish.
Andrew?
Cool.
Ben?
Interesting.
Effie?
Don't care.
There you go, that's what we think about Ubuntu introducing the HUD.
Can we say what the HUD is?
Oh, okay, so going back to what the HUD is, it's a menu replacement. So
that's not so bad.
Heads-up display.
Heads-up display. And rather than clicking on buttons, you type words. So it's named done Ubuntu's own way for applications.
Wow.
Does it make sense?
Can it do clever stuff like GNOME do?
I'm not sure.
So Ubuntu's more or less done its own version of GNOME do?
Kind of, but... I think it's more focused on application actions rather than launching applications and finding files.
Ooh.
So, you know, you want to insert a new picture in OpenOffice, you would type picture and it would use fuzzy search to find the insert picture menu entry.
Oh, that sounds quite
cool. That sounds ace.
Okay.
Oh. And what is the benefit of that? Right, then clicking
it. I guess it presents a single consistent interface. For example, if they ever do speech recognition, then that would actually augment the desktop really cleverly.
My big worry is that it's going to turn out like, you know, some applications will work with it and some won't, and it will bring more inconsistency to the desktop.
Yeah, I just wish they worked harder upstream. I really do.
Yeah.
The other advantage is you don't have to take your hands off the keyboard. If you're typing away, you've got access to all the commands right there.
Right.
It's a power user's tool, really.
Well, I really like GNOME Do. It's a brilliant tool.
I thought GNOME Do was good. I don't know how close this will be, but it's the closest comparison I can make. Anyway, enough about that.
Yep.
Too much. Red Hat is increasing the support life for Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5 and 6 to 10 years from, I think, 7 years before. What do you think, Graham?
Incredible. I think that's half a generation, and I think it's just amazing, yes.
Yeah.
Red Hat is doing something right.
Ben?
Yeah, good.
Effie?
Yeah.
Effie always gets the punchline.
Okay. Graham?
He's a funny guy.
We'll go around the other way next time.
I haven't got anything clever to say.
So yeah, and you know, comments are generally that Red Hat is only just catching up with the industry standard, really. So other major enterprise players, particularly Windows, has always supported 10 years. So they're just doing what we should have done in the first place. But you know what? I think it's great. There's going to be hardware support and, you know, security patches and things going back for 10 years.
Yeah.
I think that's getting back close to, I don't know, maybe a 2.4 kernel. That's hard work.
Yeah.
So,
and Windows, the Microsoft kind of does it out of necessity because so many people just don't move on.
Yeah, but then I think that's the case full stop with, you know, you've got a web server, it works, it runs, then you don't want to upgrade it and mess around with it.
Not mentioning any specifically.
That are running, yeah. No specific versions mentioned. Any other comments? No, good. Okay, moving on. The first Linux tablet, Linux dedicated tablet running Plasma Active, KDE's brand new jargon filled paradigm shifting desktop interface, is just been recently announced. It's called Spark. Effie, what do you think?
Who's making it?
Do you know? I don't know.
Well, it looks like it was announced by Aaron Sago, who's one of the primary developers, if not the primary developer, of the Plasma desktop and the activities thing.
Yeah, I think he's on the board of KDE.
Yeah. So I think it's him leading the project, so it's more like a community-based project, probably to give a kind of working example of what Plasma Active can do.
So someone must be manufacturing the hardware.
Yeah, well, you can also get the same tablet as an Android device.
Oh, can you? Right.
That was going to be my question. That's exactly what's going to be my question. I think it's great. It's a great thing.
Yeah, because it's open hardware, it's hackable, you can do whatever. Anyway, Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, it sounds great. I'd love to try one.
Andrew?
Plasma Active looks really nice. I installed it on a machine a while ago, and I wanted to touch the screen, even though it's not a tablet, it's just my normal monitor. I just wanted to touch it.
Excellent. That's a promising feature for touch-based interfaces in Linux. And Graham, punchline for you.
I think it's kind of noble what they're doing with Plasma Active. It does look nice, but littering the space with kind of poor user experience and kind of selling this as people expecting it to work like an iPad is just going to, I think, make things worse. I think if it was sold purely as a developer platform, purely as something for people to experiment with, that's something.
I think that is kind of the idea at this stage.
Yeah, well, in that case, then there's nothing wrong with it. It's expensive, isn't it? It's like $200, $250.
Compared to an iPad, that's cheap.
Yeah, compared to an iPad, but it's nowhere near as powerful. It's single core.
Right.
It's a pretty low core rate. It's low storage.
But, you know, if you care about your freedom, then this may be a tablet for you.
Yeah, and yeah, we do care about freedom, but I'd like to see Linux grow. I'd like to see Plasma Active in the best possible light.
Yeah, okay.
I like the idea, specifically because you can probably say within the market, this is the first device that is dedicated for Linux specifically. You buy your own computer, your own desktop, or your own laptop,
other people
and then you install
things,
Linux
yeah.
separately, isn't it? So I think that's a great thing, especially you need an alternative to iPad anyway. I think it's a great thing.
Well, it's Android.
Or the Kindle.
Yeah, or the Kindle.
Which are both Linux, so win all round, really.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's great. That's that story done. Samsung are merging their own custom operating system interface thing, BADA, for mobile phones. BADA?
I don't know.
I guess it's like BADA Bing,
BADA
maybe?
BADA Bing.
Yeah, maybe. so Samsung are merging BADA with Tizen, Migo's successor. Andrew, what do you think?
Nah.
Yeah? Graham?
Migo's successor says it all.
Ben?
I'm with Andrew. Meh.
Effie?
Bleh.
So I think we'll just move on now.
let's elaborate in case people think we just don't have it ready.
We don't know
what we're talking
that
about.
That is partly why we're going
in defense of Migo, I have got to speak your brains earlier, which might actually give us some balance.
Okay.
So, we'll come to more on that later.
Yeah, we are all bored with Intel, Moblin.
We got to say,
when was there a point when we were ever keen on it?
Well, you tried the N9.
Yes, that's true. You're right. The N9, brilliant.
Which, incidentally, I saw a report suggesting it sold more than the Lumia.
And it's not what it was never widely available.
No.
It's never been available in the UK or Australia, and it was never available in the US. Yes. Migo on the N9 was brilliant. I agree. They should have done it a long time ago. And yeah, I was wrong about Migo in the early days. They got it right.
But now.
Too late.
And now?
Oh, I don't know. Okay, without being totally deeply cynical, it might be all right. It's a pretty good interface.
Okay.
And there's lots of different television interfaces. It just needs to be intuitive so that people actually don't know what OS they're using.
Cool. Okay, fingers crossed. Greg I'm not going to be able to say this for our next story. Greg Carr Hartman.
GKH.
GKH has left Novell Sousa attachment. GKH, for those who don't know, is the infamous, famous kernel hacker. He has been traveling the world, speaking to hardware manufacturers, convincing them to let him write hardware drivers.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he actually really wrote a tutorial for us.
Did he?
About 2 years ago on writing your own drivers so that you can make your own contributions.
So if you subscribe to LXF, tinyurl.com/LXFOffer1, you can get it as a PDF.
Yeah, we've interviewed him a couple of times. Yeah, we should make the PDF available for free.
Yeah, we'll try and put it on TuxRadar later this week, or next week. Yeah. It's a shame that he's leaving Novell and Sousa, somewhere he's been for a long time. But
does he say why?
I think he wants to be in a fender neutral position so he can focus more on Linux and cross distribution work and that kind of thing. I saw something about vendor neutrality.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
If the Linux Foundation is vendor neutral.
Yeah. So a quick roundup of what we think, Ben.
It's probably bad for Novell, but good for if he's moving on to a vendor neutral position.
Cool. Effie?
I suppose good for the community, isn't it? In general.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. As long as he's still developing.
He's a very proactive guy.
If he'd left to Apple or Microsoft, I would have been sad, but this seems like a win. So, Andrew?
Yes, good for us, good for him. Bad for the running dogs of lackey capitalism, attachmate.
Yeah. Well, very. Can we say that? Graham?
Andrew would know.
Attachmate bad.
Attachment Port Novell actually seemed to be doing quite well. And Michael Meek seemed positive about the whole thing when I met him last week.
I take it back.
We like Attachmate so far.
I like Attachmate. If Michael Meek likes Attachmate, then I like Attachmate.
Yeah, that sells me on it. Graham?
I think Andrew had the last word.
Okay, there you go. And finally, just in other news, Firefox 10 is out.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yes.
What a milestone release.
In 6 weeks, we're looking forward to announcing Firefox 11, and 6 weeks after that, Firefox 12.
I think they should actually double the version number with every release.
Actually, do you know what? We're mocking it, but you know what? Over Christmas, I can't believe I missed this, but they announced...
What, Firefox 9?
No. They announced that they're introducing a long-term support version of Firefox.
Oh, yes, that's true. We should have mentioned that.
We should have mentioned that. I don't know. We were too quick to mock.
Haven't we been campaigning for that for quite a long time?
And it's happened. And then we just carry on mocking them.
Yeah, you're right. Well done, guys, for the long-term support release.
Thank you, Mozilla. You guys are awesome. And you make a great browser. So that's the end of news.
That was cool. That was good.
That was good news. Yeah. I like that.
Okay, thanks, John. Fantastic news section for the new year. It's now time for discovery of the 2 months, 6 weeks, which is amazing, really, because we all commented on how much we've actually discovered and wanted to talk about over the last 6 weeks. And then we come into the office this morning knowing that we're going to have to do something, and then I can't think of anything. Is there anyone who wants to start? Effie?
My discovery is related to a all-in-one printer scanner thing by Epson I bought. Knowingly that it may not have the driver for one of my Linux computers at home. It was primarily bought for my wife because she does still a lot of printing. And it comes with an installation disk for Windows, different versions of Windows and Mac OS. So anyway, I discovered that Epson does contribute with drivers for Linux computers, which is quite amazing.
Epson has always been really good at doing that.
Well, I didn't know. That's why it's a discovery.
Yeah,
I actually found it's the specific driver for my printer, on a different website. It's a company called Avasys, which managed all the drivers for Epson up to the end of last year. There's the management services going back to Epson now. But you can find every single driver for a printer or a scanner made by Epson on those places. So there you go.
How are they packaged? How do you install them?
How was it? How was the John? Could you help me find that driver?
Yeah, so Effie showed me, and you can get it in RPM and DEB.
Right.
For 32 and 64-bit operating systems, and there's a .src.rpm package as well. So if you want to rebuild it, I think for different distributions or different architectures, then you can do.
That's good.
I don't know if that's source code, because I guess I'm not
There's
sure.
But
I think
an
SRC can come with binary files as well as the source code. So, it seemed really cool, easy to do.
Yeah, well done, Epson. That was my discovery. nothing to do with chimichangas this time.
Well, it's too early in the year, we're all skinned.
Yeah, got no money for my burrito either.
No. Anyone else want to go next?
Okay. I
don't, yeah?
So I was telling Andrew about this yesterday, and in fact everyone, but I recently came across Def Jam Poetry, which is, this is entirely un-Linux related, but this was a show in America, a bit like, is it comedy, stand-up comedy competitions, comedy jam or something like that?
I don't know.
And basically, rather than stand-up comedians standing up and, you know, getting ranked and stuff, poets come in and perform their poetry, and the performances are amazing. Like, the poetry, you know, I've seen criticism saying it's, you know, it's a bit unheartfelt, it's cliches that no one can disagree with and things like that, but the performances are unbelievably good.
What's it called? Def Jam Poetry.
Def Jam Poetry, so D-E-F.
Like the record like label.
Yeah. And yeah, just go and check it out. Particularly, there's one called Revolution, Your Revolution, which is good. And also, there was one called The Impotence of Proofreading Your Own Work. And to go for 3-4 minutes, just putting in mistake after mistake after mistake and not actually correcting yourself. It's a really fantastic performance. I recommend you check it out. And for Linux-related discovery, Vim doesn't just have the help documentation, so you don't just type :help, you know. There's also a complete book included with Vim that you can read through cover to cover like a book. So if you type :help, enter, you'll get to the index of the help files. And as you scroll down, somewhere after a few pages of scrolling, depending on how big your terminal is, there's a link to the user manual, the user guide, and you can read it cover to cover and find out all sorts of wonderful things about Vim.
If you've got the memory to remember it all.
Yeah, you have to read it about 10 times, but by the end of that, you're flying, so.
Awesome. Great discoveries. I'll say mine, because mine is actually courtesy of a listener who one of the comments of our previous podcast, I think, said, had we seen the Razer QT desktop, the Razer Cute desktop? And I installed it this morning, and Razer QT is a desktop built just using Qt. So unlike KDE, it's got none of the encapsulation and none of the other bits of cruft that KDE adds. It's just a pure Qt-based desktop. It doesn't actually do window management. Oh. So you have to use it in, you have to use it alongside a window manager.
So you can pair it up with Compiz or Matter whatever you like.
Yeah. Lots of people seem to use OpenBox, which is probably a good idea. I didn't, unfortunately, I had to try it with Kwin because that's what I was just using it quickly. So Kwin and KDE gets in the way all over it. So, but also it's totally modular. So when you install it, when you build it, you get like 7 or 8 different components. So the desktop is just one of those. The panel is another one. The launcher is another.
Oh, nice.
There's a kicker tool. So doing almost the same as the Alt F2 launching in KDE. Yeah. And it's very, very quick.
That sounds really good.
It's the kind of thing that actually with something like the Raspberry Pi, which comes with a Qt stack installed by default, you know, something like the Razer desktop might make a nice cute alternative to XFCE or whatever they happen to be using.
Oh, that sounds good. Because KDE has been lacking an XFCE, LXD kind of equivalent, which GTK seems to have a proliferation of.
And if you've got the Qt libraries installed anyway, and if you're doing Qt development, and there's lots of reasons for doing that now.
And give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go. It's excellent. And so thanks to Spiegel 66 for that recommendation. It's really cool.
Okay, my discovery of the week. I came in yesterday and set up my desktop at Linux format office and installing a distribution. And the one I went for was Mint. And I decided to try out the new Cinnamon desktop. And I have to say, I really like it. It's really smooth. It's easy to use. And it looks nice.
I like it.
Is it better than GNOME 2.x?
Yes.
That's good. Yes. It's like GNOME 3 plus. Yeah. It's like extra cool stuff.
Well, that's brilliant.
It doesn't force you into the new GNOME 3 paradigms. It just gives you an extra way of
using it. Everything I want. It's hard to say exactly what was there because it's just what I expected. Nothing sort of sprung out. It was just natural.
Is there anyone going to fork Mint? Is there anyone going to make another distribution using the same desktop?
How do you mean?
I mean, now that Mint's so successfully done this, Does that mean that other distributions are going to use their reinterpretation of the desktop? Yeah.
Well, Cinnamon's available for a number of distributions. Yeah. And I believe it's actually the Mint team that's put them together.
Yeah. Just from right, for other distributions.
Yeah, just the main Cinnamon project page has packages for Fedora, SUSE, I think Ubuntu.
As I understand it as well, I think, I might be completely wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but Cinnamon is... just it's using GNOME shell, GNOME free technologies. It's all the JavaScript stuff. It's just rewritten and restyled, like it's new functionality using the same technology.
Right. So the panel isn't from GNOME 2.
I don't think so.
No.
Right.
It's written in, I guess it's written in JavaScript.
Like I think GNOME it's shell. Actually a fork of GNOME 3. But right. I'll have to check that.
Yeah, it is. They use GNOME 3 with some bolt ons, but for Mint 12.
Right. Yeah. Some of the Mint. Linux Mint GNOME shell extensions,
yes,
LMGs, GSs.
But I think he said that it doesn't give him the freedom to do everything that he wanted to do when you're just using extensions. So that's why he's had to go back and fork GNOME 3.
Right, interesting.
He's just done a great job with it.
Cool.
We should give it some coverage, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Go into it a bit more detail.
Yeah, I've not even tried it. So.
No, I haven't tried it either.
Maybe that would be a starting point for the Mint cover feature.
Yeah.
It's one of many things to talk about.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that is a good idea. Awesome. That leaves Andrew.
I too have discovered things. I've discovered three things. Three things. That shall be the number of the discoveries. Not four.
Or in your tax return.
Yes. I've got a letter from Dorothy House, which is a charity that's a hospice. Fairly local to us, and they participate in the gift aid scheme, so you can give them your old tatty Bernard Cornwell novels and they sell them and they don't have to pay any tax on it. And I got, because of some bizarre loophole, they're selling it on my behalf, so I got this letter saying, you know, we've sold this stuff, it's raised £50.42, which is really cool, and I can have it back if I want. If I'm that heartless, I can tick a box and send it to them, and they have to send me the money. But the reason that is that I thought of that for this podcast is that if everyone has Kindles and iPads and tablets and stuff, and that's how they read books, then charity shops will lose out on so much money because this is all books that I didn't have the space for that I've read, you know, two or three times.
But the ailing content makers will get more money.
Oh, of course.
So.
What do you mean?
Well, the publishers, the people who create all this digital content, they're really suffering because of internet piracy and things like that. So as long as people can't resell those ebooks, they'll be able to survive.
Charity shops. Leave Sony alone.
Yeah.
So they have to send you that letter now when you sell stuff through them.
Yeah.
Like, is this admin, like, tracking who donated what,
how much it sold for? It's a legal requirement.
Sending it out. How much overhead must that add to what the charity does?
Probably less than the extra money they get from being tax-exempt. But they do say on the back, you know, we're required by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs to let you know how much money, blah, 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 blah. If to save us money, let us know and we'll email you instead.
Oh, okay. That's
so,
good.
You know,
yeah.
That's great. That's a win. Third discovery... Bloomberg.
Third discovery or second
discovery? Second discovery. Bloomberg has opened its API for programmers.
Oh, yes.
Bloomberg is you tell me about this, John. I'm really stealing John's reflective glory, as are we all around this table.
Yes, that's true. for a brief moment, we knew John.
Bloomberg provides real-time business and financial data. And so while you still have to pay for a subscription to get that data, now how you consume it is up to you. So you can use their APIs to code all sorts of cool things.
In all sorts of languages as well. C++, Java, .NET, COM, Perl.
Perl, you said.
Wow.
That's a win.
That does sound cool.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Also winning on an epic scale is my third discovery, Local Motors.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a kind of an open source, crowdsourced car company. They've only got one model at the moment. It's called the Rally Fighter, but they've put out the design to the community, to people that signed up to their project. I think they retain the rights to it, so it's not free. But it looks really cool.
Is it just like a sketch? So people had spoilers and stripes on it.
Well, rather than do it like that, they just chose one winner, one the best design,
right?
And then other people could contribute to things like, I don't know, air vents. so that it wasn't people just adding ridiculous things onto it. Although it does look in a cool way, it looks really ridiculous. It's exactly how you'd imagine, you know. A bunch of Americans to you know, design your own car. It's and how hold that in your brain, and it's that. It's got a 6.2 litre engine.
Yeah, but that's just somebody typing the number into a field, isn't it? Yeah.
Somebody how else could the engine be?
Somebody doing 8.6.
6.2 litres. It's got 18 inches of travel on the front suspension, 20 inches at the back. It's crazy.
What
it's
about the sound equipment inside?
What about the sound equipment? I don't know about that.
The audio.
I'm not interested in that. No. But I sort of compared that with the Lotus Esprit, which was made in Norfolk, good old proper English engineering. And they managed to get 300 brake horsepower of only 2.2 litre engine. So they win.
It's impressive.
That was ahead of its time, before war closed the Straits of Hormuz, making oil companies rich.
Can I add that Andrew showed me the picture of his car yesterday, and like, just to try and put an image in it of your head, if you imagine some reasonably nice sports car, perhaps like, I don't know, almost a Porsche Boxster, like, and then imagine it jacked up on giant wheels. Big, so it's got like 4x4 wheels with loads of space between the wheels and the,
it sounds
like
bizarre to me.
Wheel arches.
It
looks great. It looks mean and angry. Yeah.
It is bizarre, but it works.
Or from some cyberpunk future.
Is it going to be made?
Yeah, it's being made.
Okay.
And you can, and when you order one, you get to go to the factory and help them make it.
Probably a fifth of your factory.
Anyway, I thought it was cool. Anyway, and they don't use paint either, because it harms the environment. All their cars have a vinyl wrap rather than paint.
Cool.
So they, you know, they care about that bit of the environment, but not,
but
the,
not the 8 litre, the 2 litre engine that they stuck in it.
Fuel emissions.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone. That was very good.
Yeah. Right, that's the halfway point. Still to come, we've got Rants and Raves, Speak Your Brains, and the Open Ballot.
Okay, so now it's time for Rants and Raves, a kind of new section, which isn't really new anymore, where one of us will rant about something that's angered us during the last fortnight, and one of us will rave about something that's filled them with delight. So this week, Graham's going to rant about the
Internet.
There you go. Graham, you got 1 minute.
Okay, a long time ago now, probably close to 20 years, the internet was awesome. It was just a treasure trove of information available in a very limited way. I used to love it. I had the Internet Yellow Pages, which was a fantastic book that was full of kind of pseudo adverts for gopher servers and for Usenet news groups and Telnet sites that you could just log into. It felt like you were hacking, and there was no ranting, and there was no anger, and there was no moronic comments from people. But the internet has turned rubbish. It's just full of non-objectivity. It's full of people who make absolutely zero contribution to anything other than to increase the noise. Sites like Slashdot used to be great sources of information and very intelligent conversation. They've just become full of aimless comments. The same with Engadget. I will say, actually, that tuxradar.com is the exception, because the comments and the quality of content on there is really good. But otherwise, the whole internet is rubbish, and we should do something that isn't censoring it.
Cool. Whoa. That was a lot of anger. great. Thank you, Graham. Andrew, make us feel better.
So, okay.
You got a minute. Oh, do you need a timer?
Yeah.
Hold on, let me give you a timer. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You got 1 minute to make us feel better. Go.
DOSBox. It's ace. I completed Syndicate last week. It's really hard. I never managed to do it when I was a kid. I always got stuck on the Atlantic Accelerator. That was the final level. Although you can do the levels in pretty much any order you like, but that is the hardest, and therefore the final level. You just get surrounded by enemy agents, all with miniguns, all trained on you. So if you don't move out of the way in about 3 seconds, you die. So I just used to, you know, load it up and then die instantly. And then I got bored and like probably revised my GCSEs or something instead. But not IT, because I failed that. Dustbox is great. It's really good. Are we up to a minute yet?
No, you've made it to 38 seconds.
Now that we're in this new office, we've got pictures on the walls.
They're great as well. Look, girls. She's really pretty.
No, that's Flash.
Motorbike.
You can't tell nowadays. They've all got long hair.
The cars and all the things that cool people like. Is that a minute yet?
Keep going. No, okay, you've had space enough. You made it now.
Thanks.
So Andrew kind of made us feel better. You made us feel better, but...
in a rubbish way.
Where's Mike when you
Let's
need
just cut this.
I know, it's not too bad because you only have to do it once every month.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, that's the end of Rants and Raves. If you have ideas for something you would like to rant or rave about, why don't you send us an audio recording and save us from having to do it in the podcast ourselves?
That's a brilliant idea, John.
Send it to jonathan.roberts@futurenet.com and I'll pass it to Graham and he'll put it in. So,
well, we'll play it. What we'll do is we'll play it somehow
so we can all
listen to it live.
Yeah, and we'll react.
So
please do send us your rants and raves.
That's a great idea.
No swear words.
Okay, it's time for Speak Your Brains, which is actually brilliantly positive. Maybe it's because it's been 6 weeks and people have had a bit of time to think about things, but we've had lots and lots, too many to actually read out. So I'll keep a couple back and read them in 2 weeks' time when we do the next podcast. So I'll start with Michael Mayer, who emailed us to say, I thought I'd start with something completely different from Speak Your Brains. I have two small dull but useful discoveries. The first discovery is that it's very quick to configure GNOME 3 via the appropriate command line incantations. The command to add the date to the date at the top of the bar is gsetting set org.gnome.shell.clock show date true. The settings persist in your GNOME setup. The second discovery was that you can control the number of kernels that yum retains. Just back up etc/yum.conf, edit the file and change the value of install only. And the cleanup happens only when you install a new kernel version, apparently. Okay, thanks to those.
Can I just comment on those?
Yeah, of course.
For anyone who's like, that's really cool using the command line, makes it quick and easy. But
if it's persistent, that's great.
And yeah, no, it works. But actually, there's graphical ways to do it. So gsettings is just like gconf used to be for GNOME 2. I can't tell you what the graphical tool off the top of my head is. Probably like gconf editor was the old one.
Because there wasn't one for a while, was there?
No, but I think there is a graphical one for it. So you can go and you can see all the settings, so you don't have to know exactly where the setting is. You can just browse and change stuff to your heart's content and fiddle around. And equally, your GNOME tweak tool will do very similar stuff, but for a limited subset of the things available in gsettings and gconf. There you have it.
Okay, the second Speak Your Brains is from Hugh, awesome Hugh, who sent us this on Christmas Day. And it looks like it's from his work address, so I really hope that he wasn't working on Christmas Day, or if he was, he was getting paid quadruple time. He says, I should have paid more attention a while back when you guys were talking about Migo being discontinued. I've just installed it on my creaking Acer Aspire 1, the old one with half a gig of RAM and a tiny solid state drive. It replaced Ubuntu, which was really bogging the system down. I'm enormously impressed by Migo. I'd consider small distros like Puppy, and I wanted something designed specifically for netbooks. The Migo interface is great and very intuitive once configured, but best of all, my Aspire 1 runs like a dream for the first time in its miserable life. It's a shame Migo got off to a bad start and didn't attract a following. I guess I'll have to see what the time and guys come up with next year. Brilliant. A great positive story about Migo. And then finally, I'll do one more because it's funny. Well, actually, I'll just read the first line. I actually sent this email to Mike during his reign as benevolent dictator of the podcast, but he rejected it on the grounds of it containing XML commands. I was avenged, however, by the legions of listeners who subsequently began trolling Mike with more XML. And then he goes on to include a Speak Your Brains that includes XML and commands. So I'm not going to read it out.
Nice try.
That's Speak Your Brains. Thanks, guys. If you want to, and girls, send them to me and I'll read them out next time.
What's your email address?
It's graham.morrison@futurenet.com.
Easy.
Thanks, John.
No problem.
Now it's time for open ballot.
Yay! Oh, I forgot all about that. I thought we were done.
Sorry. Sus, John.
I'm hungry.
go get a sandwich then. Which is... Oh, dear me. I don't want to do it now either.
Oh, sorry.
Now it's time for open ballot.
We asked the question, which is the biggest threat to freedom? Microsoft, Google, or Apple? What do you think came out on top? What's the biggest threat to freedom as identified by...
Canonical?
Canonical.
I think it'd be Apple.
Apple is the
one to hate these days.
It was actually a toss-up between Apple and Microsoft.
I'm surprised at Microsoft, because they've not been that bad recently.
They've just been less successful at being evil.
That's right, yeah, that's true, yeah.
Well, if we can jump straight into the comments. I'm using Anonymous Penguin, says... the worst threats of freedom comes from neither of the three companies. It comes from the ease of use that most computers provide and the extent to which they hide the underlying system. Then goes on to make a good point and ends with, but let's blame Apple. It's fun to blame companies. I mean, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a lot of negativity aimed at Google. And it's difficult to blame a company for looking after itself and trying to make money and doing what's best with the kind of assets it's got. You know, there's no moral obligation for them to do the right thing, despite the fact that Google actually did make that part of their marketing policy.
I kind of think there is a moral requirement for them too, though, when the bad things they do come down, and it comes down to exploiting user data. So, you know, if you weren't hurting anybody else or exploiting anybody else, then it's all fine, it's all good, it doesn't matter. But they're exploiting people who think they're getting a service for free and don't realize how much they're being tracked and how much they're giving away. I think from that side of things, it's morally ambiguous at best.
I do agree with you, and this really was my mum, but she wondered how on earth adverts were coming up on a totally non-related site to anything that referred to things that she'd read in an email.
Yeah.
You know, and when you actually explained her what's happened and how that happened, even she's like, that doesn't seem right, you know, because people are used to having their email private. And with all this change in Google's privacy policy to make it more homogenous, there are no mentions of whether they will or won't read your email or whether they'll actually read your documents.
No, but they have said that they'll happily share data between the services. So no longer is the data collected about you in Gmail separate from the data collected from Google Docs, separate from the Maps data. It's all merged into one, which creeps me out.
But one thing I think is a big difference between Google and the others is Google don't attempt to tie you in. So if you've done your work in Google Docs and suddenly you look at this and think, well, actually, I don't want to do this anymore, you can download it in open formats.
That's a very good point.
We interviewed somebody from Google last month, didn't we?
Yeah.
He said something very similar. Okay. So the way that they want to attract business and customers by making their product better, not by locking them in.
Yeah, and he was the guy in charge of the data liberation team at Google. But at the same time, you can't help feeling that somewhere on the dark side of the moon, there's like this empire, like in the Matrix, where they're actually rebuilding versions of ourselves from all the data that they're getting from us.
They could do that because they're really clever. Yeah.
But also with the new legislation that's being pushed through the European Parliament on what data they can hold about us, you'll be able to request for it all to be deleted if that gets ratified.
Yeah, that's true. It takes law to keep these things in check.
And can they delete the anonymized data, the kind of thing that they get from you?
According to law, it hasn't sort of gone through all the stages yet, so it'll depend exactly what format it comes out at the end.
Yeah.
So if you want them to delete the anonymized data, get onto your MEP.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
John, you mentioned Canonical as being evil. Two people agree. Padfoot says, I will add Canonical in here. Only a small fish compared to the others, but I think they are doing a monkey see, monkey do along the lines of Apple. They will attempt to be the Apple of the Linux community. And Flo says, I want to add another threat, and that is Canonical. They try to be like all of these three in one piece. Those three is Google, Microsoft and Apple. Any sensible reactions to that?
I was kind of joking about Canonical. I'm still a bit bitter about the whole Unity GNOME Shell thing. They're not in the same ballpark, but I do think that freedom is important. I think that collaboration is important in terms of it's just good in and of itself. And I feel like in some ways, Ubuntu have been less good for collaboration than other distribution.
But is it so wrong with Canonical to have one Linux company that's actually trying to pull everything into their own separate product without having the same kind of upstream commitment.
It's not. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm saying that collaboration in and of itself is probably one of the best things about Linux. There's just something inherently good about it. I argued this at length in my dissertation.
It's the reason why we're all here.
Yeah. But
if we want to see wider growth, you know, but Ubuntu could be like Android in that people don't need to care about the politics or the philosophy of free software or Linux.
But that's entirely that's the problem because if
that's
there's,
not a problem if more people are using it.
I don't care about people using it if they don't know about the freedom of it.
I want more people to use it regardless.
I want more people to know about the important role that software and technology plays in their lives and the increasingly draconian effect it's having.
And I think that would come. I think if more people using Android and then you tell them, actually, that's Linux, and that came about for these reasons, is a conversation you couldn't have with them if they were using Windows Phone.
Perhaps I don't know.
And there's a difference here between what Canonical have done building Ubuntu on top of Linux and what, say, Apple did building Mac OS X on top of BSD, which just allowed them to lock it down.
Yeah, which was licensing is important there.
And also, Apple actually wants to push out free software from its own software stack. Yeah. You know, they don't like Samba, they want to get rid of it. Sorry, Andrew.
William Judd. William the Yellow Dart Judd. Says, well, all three companies you've mentioned do limit freedom within their own platforms in various ways. Only Microsoft has a history of attempting to lock down the wider world through spreading FUD and their embrace, extend and extinguish approach to computing standards. By contrast, Apple and Google are relatively benign entities that don't impact the greater ecosystem. Recently, though, Apple has been claiming protection fees from Android handset manufacturers, which would put them more in Microsoft's camp.
I think that's interesting, but I would like to say that Apple, I think, do have a history. You look at what they do in the App Store and how they censor and how locked down that platform is and how once you're in their ecosystem, there's no getting out.
And just the sheer scale of the patents they're claiming to have.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's patents on rectangles. That's pretty daft.
And a mirror smooth lake, or looking like a mirror smooth lake on the iPad.
Was that the phrase they used?
I got that from BBC, so I don't know what it's gone through, but yeah.
Awesome. A good point for anyone concerned about evil in Google comes from Gallifrey, or James the Madman, who says, I use DuckDuckGo, 7! P.S.
He's trying to do a search in DuckDuckGo there.
He also says, that's it, I used DuckDuckGo. P.S. It's a pity Mike's gone, so hi, John.
Does it actually say that?
Just say that.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
What is it, James the Madman?
We've missed, obviously, the biggest and most evil thing of all, which, hopefully...
It's Satan.
Hopefully some of our commenters have corrected our oversight, and that is the American government.
Well, we were told we couldn't put that by that guy stood in the corner.
Does Fads Gaff says, the American government is the greatest threat to freedom the world has ever known. Well, quite a lot of people have said, sort of, you know, agree in rather more sensible terms. Governments are a much bigger threat than any of these companies. The answer to any wrongdoing seems to me to always be, let's restrict the freedom of the public, not let's find the people responsible and prosecute them through the courts. That's this cat. Hawkins says, the biggest threat to freedom are governments by far. Microsoft, Apple and Google are a limited threat, but nothing compared with our governments. Mike Holden says, I'd like to say that SOPA and PIPA are the first major... These are the internet piracy laws that are currently being debated in America. Are the first major attacks on our freedom. I began computing in 1986. I'm still chugging along in my blogs. And I saw this coming. The US government wants every computer operator to use DOS and thumb drive to transport information. And Squiggle says... It's the government and the courts and all the legal proceedings going on that are messing the internet up. Mega Upload was a prime example that if they don't care if you rely on a service, I've read that out wrong. But trust me, it's a good point. And Nye says, the obvious one is the US government.
Mm. I mean, I do think there's an interesting point. I do think that there must be more to a government's obsession with things like SOPA and things like the Anti-Copyright Act, more than just keeping the media industries on their side, it works very conveniently for them as well, in terms of giving them more control.
Yeah, that
and the laws.
I've never considered that before, to be honest with you.
They can say, yeah, we're doing it to preserve the media industry's integrity, but in fact,
as well. Yeah, that's interesting.
And that is a bit scary.
I do think, though, that people who are, I don't know enough about this to go into detail, really, but I know Lawrence Lessig has put together some really interesting discussions about how code is law. If you read the book Code, I think there's version 2 out, Code 2.0, quite a while ago now. But the idea is that code is law in the new digital world. So kind of the environment that shapes how we can act and what we're allowed to do is informed by social norms, by government regulations, and now by code as well. So suggesting that the US government has massive... is massively more important than the companies who are writing the code that everyone is using, I'm not altogether sure is right. I think there's kind of I think Lawrence Lessig had a point about there being a three-way tie, and Apple, Google, and Microsoft between them write the code that vast majorities of us use. So,
but sort of the counter example, if you look at, say, the situation in China, which is obviously on a lot more extreme than where America's going, then the government is completely locked down everything, and no amount of code is going
to... Well, at the same time, services like Tor do help Chinese dissidents to connect to the outside world, and it's helped in places like Libya. So code is able to circumvent the laws in that regime. Although, interestingly, the government are also using code to enforce their laws. So,
it's a really good point.
Another thread that came out of the comments is that apathy is the biggest threat to freedom.
What was that?
Apathy is the biggest threat to freedom. Team 137 says it's the ignorance and apathy of people that is the real threat. Dapool Daddy says, as much as I like to bash on Microsoft, Apple, and occasionally Google, it's public apathy of how laws are made that creates the greatest threat to our freedom. And Sultan of Swing says that the biggest threat is a combination of general ignorance and apathy by the computer using public. Looking at most of the other comments here, it's clear that we know what the dangers are and are better positioned to choose those which value freedoms. However, there is a vast majority of people who do not know what we are even talking about. Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that ICT should cover at schools.
It is. Let's get on to Michael Gove and let him know.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for all your contributions.
There is one more thing.
Oh.
Yeah. Well. It's...
okay, get off.
It's when you have a word and then an apostrophe and an S... That's not a way of making it plural. That's it shows that either something's been abbreviated or that there's a possessive there or a genitive, if you want to use the actual proper grammar term. Normally the comments on people leave on the Tux Radar are really, really well written, good grammar, good spelling, but you're really letting the side down at the moment. You know, seriously, it doesn't take much.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Thanks for that.
Although the standard of debate is very high.
Yeah, I think that's the important
thing. That's the amazing thing. As you say, the internet is full of morons, and none of them are on Tux Radar.
Lots of contributors, English isn't their first language.
That's true.
Sorry, that was me, Andrew. I left all those comments.
Apologies.
But regardless of grammar, thanks for contributing. Thanks for listening. It's good to be back. And we'll all see you again in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
Bye.
Yay.